I'd like to invite you back again to Psalm 62, please. Psalm 62. The two most basic fundamental categories of all that you and I know are the Creator and what He has created. And the distinction between them is absolute and fundamental. It must not be ever blurred or lost. In fact, we must recognize that everything that the Creator made was for the glory of the Creator, that everything is to live magnifying His glory, depending on Him. That was why and how He created us in that way. The Scriptures are abundantly clear about that, and that was precisely the problem with the fall, the rebellion of man. Rather than living under the authority of the Creator, mankind broke out from under that, chose to trust our own wisdom rather than God's, sought to exalt ourselves rather than God, and that's why the Scriptures say we sin and fell short of the glory of God. Redemption really is the work of God to bring His creation back into a right alignment with Him, ultimately with Jesus Christ being exalted as the head over all things. You and I coming to understand, if we're genuinely converted, that we must turn to God. In fact, the current, I think, and constant battle in our lives is that one. Will God hold exclusive claim to our worship? And will God be the exclusive one in whom we trust? Everywhere we turn, we have substitutes held up to us for us to give our devotion to them. All around you, every day as you walk through this world, you have people whispering in your ear like the serpent did, saying, well, yeah, God said this, but... And you're faced with choices as to whether or not your exclusive confidence will be in God, that you will believe Him, that you will trust Him, and therefore follow Him. Therefore, obey Him. Therefore, honor Him. That's the constant and continual battle for us. And it's no wonder, then, that the Psalms, which are so rich with where we live, touch on this so continually. That in the course of life, those who were devoted to God would experience the circumstances of life in such that they would be called to challenge and question what's going on in their lives. That was the Psalm of Lament. And in the midst of that Psalm of Lament, in trouble, the psalmist says, turn to God, not away from God. In this kind of a psalm that we're looking at, it's a parallel kind of concept. That is, in trouble, trust in God. Make certain that you express your confidence. And often in the Psalms of trust or confidence, they actually have something of a rootedness in what God has done previously or in their understanding of who God is. And so the lament side of it is not so big like we saw in the other Psalm. And even in the Psalm of Thanksgiving, which talked about what had happened and how God had delivered, in this particular case, the tension, the trouble, is sort of like the backdrop for what's going on. We know it's there because it's hinted at in many of the Psalms. In this case, it's outright stated. There's trouble. But the whole focus of the Psalm is not on the trouble moving to trust like a lament. It's on the trust in the midst of the trouble. The emphasis is on the fact that God is exclusively and supremely the object of our confidence in the face of it. And you could see that, I hope, as we read this psalm, that that's where David is in this, and that he's in a circumstance and situation in which there's adversity, opposition in his life. Yet the bulk of what he's saying here is an expression of his confidence in God and in what God will do. In fact, verses 1 and 2, we see it right off the start of the psalm. My soul waits in silence for God only. From Him is my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not be greatly shaken. David's confidence here is expressed because God is the only hope of salvation. In verse 1, he waits for Him alone. That word only shows up at least 7 times in the original language, and you can see it at least 4 very clearly in 1, 2, 5 and 6, that the emphasis here is the exclusivity of God as His hope. He waits, therefore, for God only. From Him is His salvation. The concept of waiting in silence might strike us as strange in a number of ways. One, in that we normally are told to pray in trouble, and in fact, here's a psalm that's written while someone is waiting in silence. And in fact, a psalm that tells people in verse 8 to pour out their heart before the Lord. And a psalm that concludes addressing God. So when we think of waiting in silence, we probably should just step back for a moment and think that that is not necessarily that the psalmist is speechless completely, but that it's really talking about a disposition, an inner attitude of his heart in which he is composed and waiting before the Lord. He's resting in the confidence that God will act. It's the kind of thing at times we've probably all experienced, that we know something's happening, but we know the person who's going to solve the problem is about to solve it or coming to solve it. And rather than being frantic and running our mouths and engaging ourselves anxiously in things, we just wait. We just compose ourselves and recognize that at this moment, there's nothing that we can do. We need somebody else to do something. And that's what David, I think, is expressing here. He says, my soul waits in silence for God only. That He is the one who can come, because from Him is my salvation. And the idea of salvation here, though we certainly, I think, can extend it out to the way we talk about salvation, I think the salvation is deliverance. It's rescue from God, which is the picture of our salvation. We're lost in sin, under condemnation. The great enemy of our soul has us captured and held captive. And that's why the scriptures talk about our salvation as salvation. God rescues us from the wrath to come. He delivers us from the snare of the devil. He frees us from condemnation. It's salvation in that regard. It's a wonderful picture of it. And in fact, throughout the Old Testament, there are quite literal pictures of that kind of redemptive salvation. Israel, as slaves in Egypt, brought out of Egypt by the hand of the Lord, was saved. But we know when it says that not every individual Israelite was personally redeemed. It was God's work of salvation that rescued them and delivered them. In this particular case, David is saying his enemies have set up battle against him. They're seeking to harm him. God will save him. He will rescue him. From God, that kind of deliverance will come. And so he's looking at it in that way. He probably has prayed. He and certainly has expressed himself as he often did. And he accepts a position of composed rest in God. And look why he can do that. Verse 2, the source of his salvation is God. And in fact, and because it's a sure, solid source, he has confidence in the face of trouble. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. Those pictures Those pictures are intended to create images that obviously to us in some sense as city and suburban dwellers don't have the same kind of scenario as if we lived in a much more wilderness-oriented type of thing, or we were a warrior like David, who in the middle of a battle in which you didn't have like instruments that could shoot for miles and be targeted, you faced people who shot arrows, threw spears, fired rocks. Having a rock to hide behind was a place of great security. Being in a fortress with a strong tower that didn't have to worry about some kind of, you know, tomahawk missile that could devastate the whole city in a moment. That was a statement of great security. It was inside, in our kind of language, a safe and secure bunker. He had a shield for him that could protect him from harm. He felt and recognized the security of God in that so that he could say, look at the end of verse 2, I shall not be greatly shaken. Now, this is where some of the translations differ on it. Some say, I shall never be shaken. It's interesting, and I draw it out because you may have noticed when we read it, the parallel between verse 2, for instance, and verse 6. Look over to verse 6. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. Same as verse 2, really. Then look what the end of it says. I shall not be shaken. The end of verse 2 says, I shall not be greatly shaken. There's a difference in the wording there. And there's a difference as to the significance of that difference. All right. The one way of understanding it would be something like this. Verse 2, he says, I will not be shaken very much or for very long. By verse 6, he says, I will not be shaken at all. That it's a growth in his confidence, that there is a sense in which he moves from a sense, because if this is set in the backdrop of David having to flee Jerusalem because of Absalom, which it seems to be, David is out in the wilderness having been chased off by his rebel son and his forces, and David says in verse 2, I won't be down for long. He has confidence in God. I will not be shaken completely or forever. I will not be shaken greatly. And then as he moves forward and addresses his adversaries and then restates his confidence in God, he removes the word that's translated greatly and just says, I will not be shaken. Because of who God is, he has this confidence in the face of trouble. Look at verses 3 and 4 because they show us the conflict that he was involved in. How long will you assail a man that you may murder him, all of you, like a leaning wall and like a tottering fence? And this verse is notoriously difficult to translate. That's why this morning you probably have a number of different ways in which it's translated. The King James and New King James actually take that part about murder and apply it to the enemies. They will be slain. Then others take the word murder like NASB and take it to batter and tie it to the wall a little bit. That is, you batter the wall down. And a part of the reason why you have the variety in the translations is because it's a pretty complicated set of words that David uses here. The basic idea, I believe, is that it's best to take the end of verse 3 as setting up the picture of verse 4 at the beginning of it. Look at the end of verse 3. Like a leaning wall, like a tottering fence, they have counseled only to thrust him down from his high position. That is, the idea of the tottering wall begins to picture something that can be pushed over. And their goal in verse 4 is to pull it down. David's saying, I'm like a fence that has been crashed and is tottering, a wall that's about ready to fall, and my enemies are trying to push it over. They're trying to bring me down from my high position. They're trying to inflict this damage on me. And obviously, I believe it would go to the extent of actually taking his life, but it was chiefly an issue of rebellion against him. They wanted to take away the kingship from him. They wanted to pull him down from his position of honor and authority in that regard. And that's why I think this is most often taken in connection with Absalom, which I'm assuming a certain amount of familiarity with. But the Cliff's Note version of it is David's son Absalom, in anger and rebellion against David, stood at the gates of the city for a long period of time. And when people would come in and bring their case to the king to get it judged, Absalom would do the double deal kind of a way of saying, what was said? Oh, here's what should have been done for you. And he consistently made himself look better than the king until finally he had secured enough allegiance because he had promised them. He was being quite political and promising them all of the things that they wanted to hear. He won the hearts of people so that eventually he was able to chase David out via a rebellion. And in fact, in this way, look at the kind of descriptions that are in verse 4, because I think they fit with that kind of scenario that his enemies are willing to do this toppling through deception and cursing. It says in verse 4, they have counseled only to thrust him down from his high position. They delight in falsehood. The idea here is that they're accomplishing their objective through deception. They give counsel, but it's only intended to pull down the leader. There is a delight in falsehood. That last part of verse 4 sort of captures the treachery of it. They bless with their mouth, but inwardly they curse. And the idea here is of praising somebody in a blessing or cursing them, speaking evil of them, not necessarily casting a curse on them, but to speak ill of them. And so here's the idea that David says, they bless with their mouth. That is, they praise me, but inwardly there's really cursing, which I think he would say is being expressed out. That's why you could see the picture of Absalom living in his father's kingdom, enjoying the benefits of being the king's son, offering counsel that's all designed to pull David down, that he's going along with the outward flow of things, talking about things in a positive way, but then inwardly there's this evil intent. So David knows something here in the midst of his trouble of those who are actually trying to harm him in a more physical way, but also those who are intended to dishonor him, to discredit him in such a way that they would pull him down from his position of honor. That these enemies had operated in this kind of self-centered and sinful way to inflict harm on him. And then look at verse 5, because now he calls really himself and the people of Israel to trust in God again and us by virtue of the psalm. And you can see, as has happened in a few places as we've looked at, he starts to talk to himself again. Look at verse 5. My soul wait in silence for God only, for my hope is from Him. That's why I say this really, verses 5 through 8 is an invitation to trust in God. The first part of that invitation is to himself. He reminds himself to wait for God alone. We did this morning, right? The last hymn we sang, "Be still my soul, the Lord is on your side." We are doing what David's doing here. We're singing a hymn that is actually directed to ourselves. It's telling us truth about God in order to fortify our confidence in God. It's intended to take us, so to speak, by the spiritual nape of the neck and bring us to a reminder that God is worthy to be trusted. And that's what David did here. And in fact, I said 2 weeks ago, you and I need to do regularly. We need to talk to ourselves, to sing to ourselves, to remind ourselves of the trustworthiness of God and His promises, that we have to be willing to stop and do that. He in verse 1 says, my soul waits in silence. Now he says, my soul wait in silence. He's turning and directing it to himself. The word hope here is substituted in the parallel from verse 1 with salvation. His hope of deliverance, his source of of confidence is from God. Look at again the picturesque language in verse 6. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. In verse 8, he adds, the rock of my strength, my refuge is in God. So again, the pictures that David points for us are intended to give us an image or an expression of a person who's under attack, running to a place of security. That place is in God. God is the rock. He's the stronghold. He's the refuge. That we are placing ourselves in a position of dependence on God. We're trusting in Him in that regard. Look at the first line of verse 7, because this, I think, is an important statement in light of what he'll say in a moment in the psalm. On God, verse 7, on God my salvation and my glory rest. Let's think about that phrase there, my glory rest. What does David mean here? What I think David is saying, in fact, another way of translating it is my honor, that what David is talking about is, in his immediate context, is the enemies have sought to pull him down from his high position. He's the king. He's the one who has the honor of being the king. He's the anointed one. He's the ruler of God's people. He's in that position of honor. They have attempted through violence and deception to pull him down from that. And David expresses his confidence. He says this, it's on God that my honor rests. If I'm going to receive honor, if I'm going to be exalted as the king, then it's in God's hands. It's His job, if I could put it that way. He made me king. He will sustain me as king. My honor is in God's hands, not my own. He's willing to leave it to God in that regard. He is not going to press beyond that. Then look what he does in verse 8. He calls the people to trust. He calls the people to trust. Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. David uses his own confidence in the midst of conflict as an opportunity to call others to have confidence in the Lord and trust Him, to look to God in it. In other words, the way this works is this. What God has been for David, He will be for other people. That is, He has been David's rock and stronghold and refuge, and now David says, God is a refuge for us. What He has been for me, He will be for you. He has helped me in this specific time. You can trust Him at all times. Look at the language of verse 8. Trust in Him at all times. So his specific experience of confidence in God in the midst of trouble becomes an opportunity to call all people to trust in God and to call all people to trust in God at all times. And I think that would do us well to meditate on that somewhat, because I think that we can develop a pattern of life that functionally excludes God unless there's trouble. As we're pretty self-sufficient. We pretty much run on our own, do all right, and until trouble comes. And what we need to learn to recognize, probably the simplest way to do it is, you're always in trouble. You just tend to see only the material, physical troubles you face. You don't tend to focus on the spiritual troubles that are constantly waging war on your soul. David here is dealing with a specific adversity and circumstance, but the reality of it is it becomes a pattern for all of God's people in the course of life that we are involved in a great spiritual battle, and at all times we must trust God in the battle. If we do not have the exclusive heart of confidence like David's talking about, then we will be prone for a battle. So we need to recognize we're always in trouble, and we need to continually turn ourselves to a constant confession of the fact that God alone is our hope. God alone is our rock and salvation. And we must recognize that we cannot trust in ourselves. And we do that. Look at the verse 8. How do we do that? Pour out your heart before Him. The idea of that language, again, is picturesque. That what's in our heart, where we're the seat of our lives, our affections, our thoughts, that we would lay those out before the Lord. We would, like almost like a pitcher, take and pour out what's in us before God as a way of expressing our dependence on Him, our need for Him, our recognition of our insufficiency, the recognition that we can do the best we can do, but we cannot protect ourselves ultimately and finally. We can attempt everything that is to be done, but the strength and power does not belong to us. So we have to pour ourselves out before the Lord. And in a very real way, that second line of verse 8 probably becomes not just the way in which we express the first line, but probably the measure of it. That is, trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him. Those two fit together in such a way that we show our trust by pouring out our heart before Him. And, in fact, if we do not pour out our heart before Him, we show that we are not trusting in Him at all times. We're actually trusting in ourselves. The as I've said before, to my own conviction, prayerlessness is an evidence of our trust in prayerlessness is an evidence of our confidence in ourselves. That we do not have an explicit and clear sense of dependence on God. That's why we don't pray. It's those cases where we get pressed to the ground, so to speak, and feel as if we've reached the end of our rope that we say, all right, I need to talk to God about this now. As if there's some kind of, you know, organizational chart, and we've got to keep doing everything here until we get it up to the final, okay, now I finally reached a point where I can only appeal to the boss. Instead of living constantly in a state of communion with the Lord and dependence on Him, in which we recognize that He is our strength and our stronghold, our refuge, and we must constantly run to Him. I mean, you realize there's no such thing as a big or small problem for God, right? I mean, a cold and cancer are no different from God's perspective. They are to us. But do you think one tires God out more than the other one? Do you think God ever sits in heaven and goes, ooh, they've got a big problem. I wonder what I can do about that. There are no big or small problems to God. So God is not going to be offended if he would rebuke us, according to the Scriptures, if we are failing to obey Him. So I'm not arguing against obedience, all right? So if we refuse to work, the Scriptures say we shouldn't eat. So if somebody refuses to get a job and says, Lord, You're my rock, my stronghold, my refuge, please feed me, then there's a problem there. All right, but let's just take disobedience and set it aside, and I'll tell you why in a moment. We come to the end of the psalm. Let's take a life and heart of a believer who wants to honor God and walk with God. See life like this: there's God, and there's me. He's my Creator. I'm His creature. I have an absolute 24/7 every area of my life responsibility to honor Him, serve Him, walk in obedience to Him. So in everything in my life, there is a responsibility to turn Godward. Whether therefore ye eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. There's no non-God part of my life. None at all. Every area of my life has to turn Godward in worship. Should only be able to be done if it can be done for God. Now if I look at life like that, then I need His help all the time. Because everything is an expression of my faith commitment. Everything is an expression of my acknowledgement of God. And I need to trust Him to handle all of that in a way that honors Him. I must pour out my heart before Him continually so that I live as if He is my refuge. That's why I think the great danger for us, the great danger for us, and I say this, recognizing we're all made of the same stuff, but our culture has so conditioned us to, and we have surrendered to live in this world, that think about the great problems, small problems, big problems. Almost everything that fits a big problem in American Christianity has something to do with our life in this world. Almost always, when calamity comes, it's something that has to do with living in this world. Health, finances, trouble in some kind of temporal relationship. It's all here. It tends not to be, boy, the big trouble in my soul is my struggle with sin. The big struggle in my life is someone who doesn't know Christ or someone who's not walking with the Lord. How often do we actually even engage that battle and recognize our absolute, utter dependence to trust on God? And so we pour out our heart before Him. David calls us to do that because he had found God to be completely trustworthy, and in fact, he had found others not to be. Look at verses 9 through 12, because here I think is, in some senses, really the point of this psalm. That is that David is calling us to trust in God alone because other things are not trustworthy and God is. Look at verses 9 and 10 because he tells us that man and man's methods are vanity. Men of low degree are only vanity and men of rank are a lie. In the balances they go up, they are together lighter than breath. Do not trust in oppression. Do not vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. Through a powerful combination of images here, David tries to make it clear to us that there's no hope when you put your trust in men or in men's methods, that in fact, whatever their state or rank, look at verse 9, low degree men of rank, whatever their status in life, if they're a nobody or if they're hugely a somebody, they're nothing. Low rank are vanity, low degree, that's the word that is so common in Ecclesiastes. It's an emptiness. There's a vanity to it in that regard. Those who are men of a high position are a deception. It's a fraud for them to have the appearance that they actually have control of everything. I mean, I recognize on some level we say, like for instance, our president is the most powerful man on the planet. Well, yes, that's true, but you know what? That's not very powerful. I mean, in the big picture, one storm from God can create as much chaos as our armies do. That God, His power so supersedes anything of any exalted man that we might think of. And he says it's a deception. Don't look at Don't look at people of power like that and think they hold all the power. It's empty. It's deceitful. There's no power ultimately in that. Look at verse 9. The second part of verse 9 really sort of gives us the sum of it. In the balances they go up, they are together lighter than breath. I know some people probably have heavy breath, but in this particular case, even the heaviest breath on an early morning is not very heavy, right? And the point here is the old idea of a scale. You have something on a scale, and you put it on this side, you put something on this side, and you balance it by getting them even. And basically what he says is this, is you put them on that side, put anything else on the other side, boom, their side goes up. You put them there, there's nothing there. Put anything over here. In fact, you put them there and they're lighter than breath. They won't even weigh it down. Won't even move the scale, is what David's saying here. And then look at verse 10. He says, listen, don't do what they do then. Do not trust in oppression. Do not vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. Men try to take power to themselves by oppression. They try to take it through possessions, whether they rob people of them or accumulate them. They think to have is to be more. And so probably that's what's actually happening with these enemies of David. They're trying through oppression and robbery to take what is his so that it can be theirs, so that they can have the place of power and influence. And David says, don't trust in those things. Don't put your hope in what my enemies are hoping in. Don't think that those things will deliver. Why? Verse 10, they're vain. Do not vainly hope. You have an empty hope if you trust in oppression or robbery. And then he says, if riches increase, do not set your heart upon them, because they won't actually do it either. Words that probably Paul picks up on in 1 Timothy 6 when he says, when people get things of this world, do not set your trust in them, your heart on them, because they ultimately cannot. They cannot do it. He says, fix your hope on God. So David stands back in the midst of a wilderness experience, literally chased out by his own son. As he goes out into the wilderness, he has this obnoxious guy cursing him from the mountain. He's the mighty man, the warrior, but he's chased out. His home is defiled. He seems to have lost his kingdom. But he says, hope in God. Trust in God. Don't trust in what may seem to work temporarily. I mean, if you're just an observer, let's say you're some middle rank soldier somewhere in there, and you see your king run out to the wilderness, apparently defeated, you see a new king seeming to exalt himself, and you're sitting there thinking, all right, what's the smart way to go here? Do I go out with David and get killed with him? Or do I side with Absalom and the rebels and maybe seize an opportunity here? David says, don't trust in oppression and robbery. Don't set your heart on those things. Because those are temporary and shallow. They will not ultimately overcome. And so look at the flip side of his convictions, verse 11. Once God has spoken, twice I have heard this. That's a typical wisdom way of basically just getting our attention and saying, this is important. Power belongs to God, and loving kindness is yours, O Lord. For you recompense a man according to his work. Here David brings it back into focus. And I'm going to underscore this sentence for you, because this is really where it all heads. What David is saying here is that God alone is able and willing to rescue those who walk uprightly before him. That's where he leads this whole discussion toward. That God has the power, that's the ability, that God has loving kindness, a sort of steadfast, loyal love and mercy toward His people. That's the commitment. God is able and willing to act on behalf of those who walk uprightly before Him. The end of verse 12. For you recompense a man according to his work. That shouldn't scare us. He's not talking about some kind of work salvation here. Remember, this is a Psalm of Israel. It's in the worship of the covenant people under the Mosaic Covenant. The Mosaic Covenant had very clear statements. Obedience brings blessing. Disobedience brings cursing. The servant of God in Israel had a responsibility to obey the promises of God and the covenant obligations of God given. And if he did, he could expect God to bless him. And if he didn't, he could expect God to judge him. There was a certain clarity to what God had said. That's why you can find things stated in the book of Proverbs like that. Honor the Lord with your substance. And so here's what will happen. God had promised them these things. And so David takes his stand on the basis of God's promises to Israel, to the faithful Israelite. And he says this, God, you have the power. God, you have loving kindness toward your covenant people. You will deal with us according to our work. And so David's resting his case on the fact that he's trusted God. He's walking. He wants to walk in obedience to God. God will act on behalf of him. That power and loving kindness belong to the Lord. That's an expression of his confidence in the very character of God. Now, let me say, how does that fit in with what we're talking about? Well, and I'd encourage you at some point maybe just to think through this. Maybe sometime, maybe in the new year would be a good thing. Or it really shouldn't take you the whole year, so maybe that wouldn't be a good thing. But read the New Testament epistles and ask yourself, as you read them, how many times the motivation for your life is rooted in the fact that you can have absolute confidence that God will in fact accomplish His good purposes with regard to you. I mean, just take one book, like the book of 1 Peter. And you find, for instance, as sort of a crystallizing statement of it, that those who suffer according to the will of God should entrust their souls to Him in doing what's right. That is, that Peter would say to us where we live right now, all right, so if you're in adversity and you don't deserve it in the human frame of it, that is, I mean, we all deserve, you know, because we're sinners. Right? But on the other hand, as we're seeking to walk in obedience before God, there are things in which we suffer by virtue of our obedience to God and doing what's right and the rebellion of the creation against God. The fact that God is the Creator and He still controls it all is the point and basis of reference that we must stand on the truth that there is not going to be ultimate unrighteousness. God will judge. He will do what's right. And right now, may be the time of adversity. It might be the time of suffering. It might be the time of great difficulty. It may be undeserved. It may be unjust. It may be the work of treachery and deceit. It may be the work of oppression and robbery. It could be whatever motivates the sinful heart of people to turn and attack. The answer of your soul in the midst of it has to be, my soul, wait only for God, for my salvation is from Him. He is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not be shaken. And your word to anybody else should be, trust in the Lord, all you people. Pour out your heart before Him. He is a refuge for us. And the reason we say that is because we have heard We've heard it said so clearly, so specifically in the Scripture, power belongs to God. That's a declaration. Then he turns to God and he said, and loving kindness is yours. You will recompense a man according to your work. That is, I think David has a sort of a double-edged sword there. I think David's saying this, my oppressors will receive from God the recompense of their work. I will receive from God the recompense of my work. So David was motivated by the justice and power of God toward obedience. Even if that obedience means that he has to wait silently for a deliverance that comes from God. David understood what it meant to go to battle. He understood what it meant to walk into the face of a giant, Goliath, and say to that giant, all right, you come to me with a sword and a spear. I come to you in the name of the Lord. Now think about this, and I'm not trying to question all of our little Bible story stuff, and it's really the point. What did David have in his hand? He had a sling and a stone. He didn't just say, Yahweh, and watch Goliath fall. When he says, I come in the name of the Lord, he's saying, I've come out to battle you, but I know that my fight will do nothing unless God does it. And so he was confident that when he took that stone and he threw it, that God would fight the battle. His confidence was in them. And there's a time in which we have to use the means that God has told us. We have to step out in faith in God to do something because God has told us to do it. But there's also a time. There's a time when we have to just stop. And we have to say, Lord, my soul waits in silence before you. Because God, whether we step out or we stop in silence, it is God who is our rock and our stronghold and our refuge. Because at the end of the day and all through the day, what God is working to do in your life and my life is to get us back focused on Him. So that everything that comes from the hand of God is what we live by. That the focus of our life is God, not our problems, not our ambitions, not our dreams, but the focus of our life is God. Because to Him belongs all the glory forever. Amen. Let's pray. Father, please help us to become so centered and focused on You that we do find the confidence that David expresses here. That we can say, not just with our lips, but with the composure and calmness of our heart, that You are our rock and our stronghold, our refuge. That it's on You that depends our salvation and our honor. Lord, please work in us that kind of confidence in You, because it's the only kind that You are worthy of. Help us to see how sinful it is to lack confidence in You. To trust in ourselves or trust in our friends or trust in strategies or techniques more than we trust in You. Lord, we know the battle, the horse is prepared for the day of battle, but the victory is Yours. So help us never to trust in the means, but always to trust in You. Lord, I don't know the specific battles and adversities that that our church family is facing now, individually and personally. But please take this psalm of trust and use it to stir up confidence in you. A recognition that both power and loving kindness belong to you. That you are able and willing to act on behalf of those who are trusting in you. Who have turned their lives into your hands. And Father, please open eyes this morning. Help us to see that our only hope ultimately of salvation is in you. That we cannot trust in ourselves. We cannot trust in our works. We cannot trust in our righteousness. What a shame for anyone to come here and think that on the day they meet you, they will be able to trust and explain their own works, their own righteousness, their own goodness. Lord, please open eyes that there is only one who has been righteous completely. There is only one who has paid the penalty fully. There is only one with power to save, and that's Jesus Christ. And may they cast their soul into His care. Lord, please be glorified in us, we ask, in Jesus' name. Amen.